welcome to episode 42 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thanks as always, folks, for tuning in. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcast. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. Joined now by Mike Oitzman, the editor of our robotics group here at WTWH Media. Mike, what's up, man? Spend a minute. Haven't done this in a bit. We've been heads down in RBR 50 judging, but what's going on, man?
Hey, Steve. Yeah, it's great to be here, and it's great to take a break from the RBR 50 adventure. It's been quite an interesting process. It's been really fun to sit in.
That's a good word, adventure. I like it.
Choose your own adventure.
Yeah. Got some interesting stories this week, Mike, including a conversation with A3 President Jeff Bernstein about the North American robot shipment numbers from the first quarter of the year. Also a conversation with the leadership team at Wibotic. I know you know those guys pretty well and their wireless charging solution. But I think we got to start off here. This is the second time I think I've opened the show apologizing to a company. And I want to apologize to NASA. Silly me for ever doubting that they'd get the Ingenuity helicopter to fly on Mars. They've completed, what, 5 flights now? They're about to prepare for a scouting mission to see how it can help with future missions on Mars and other planets. But it's been amazing, Mike, to watch the Mars helicopter flights over the last couple of weeks, see how the helicopter, see it demonstrate what it can actually do. They've had some hiccups along the way, but overall, a giant success. A giant step for a tiny machine millions of miles away. And really, Mike, we're at the beginning of the Mars Perseverance mission. It's just starting to do its thing. It hasn't really driven that far across the Mars surface yet. So shame on me for ever doubting the brilliant, brilliant minds at NASA JPL. And you tried to tell me, but I just didn't listen to you.
I think, it's quite interesting that Ingenuity is going to now try to scout the terrain ahead for Perseverance. That's what's next on the docket. And I suspect that was the plan all along, assuming there wasn't some major failure, which, they've hit all the milestones. So, I think the best part about the recent NASA missions is that, they have a reputation for under-promising and over-delivering. And that's why they keep, scoring so high with the public. And, I think, and by the way, we're working with the media office at JPL to coordinate some guests from NASA on a future episode. So stay tuned for that. And, that'll be a fun show to both produce and listen back to. And I think, meanwhile, while back here on Earth, I think we've got lots of related stories in the news over the last couple of weeks. I posted a story about Exyn drones and their release of new level 4 autonomy in an application for underground mine exploration and for applications like search and rescue. The innovation with Exyn is that they're doing everything on board the drone, as there's limited connectivity when you're down buried deep in a mine. And I think it's very similar to what the Mars missions are doing that we just discussed. And we're also following the progress of the DARPA subterranean challenge, talk about being underground, which wraps up again this fall with the final phase of competition. I think that competition's been going on for the last three years, and the pandemic sort of deferred things a bit. So they're anxious to get back to the final phase of that. I think, all of this news should be inspiring to this next generation of roboticist engineers and startups. So, Steve, what do you have on the investment side this week? I know you've posted quite a few stories.
Yeah, talk about inspiring. How about all the money, Mike, that's being dumped into these different vertical markets within the robotics industry? Of course, this is something that we've done for a while. These monthly robotics investments, you can check them out. And all those other stories that Mike mentioned on therobotreport.com. But for April 2021, Mike, we tracked 38 robotics investments. Wow. I broke them up different. So we did robotics investments, which is pure funding plays. And then we also had separate mergers and acquisitions. There were 8 of those. And there was also 1 IPO in April 2021. Again, we have a full roundup on therobotreport.com. Just check out the investments section. But for April 2021, we tracked 38 robotics investments worth more than $4.8 billion. A lot of times these companies, Mike, don't disclose the actual amount of the funding. We can track them down sometimes, but a lot of times they don't get released. Or if it's a company in Asia or another part of the world where we're very far removed from, it's somewhat difficult to find that number as well. But that April 2021 number, quite a rebound from the same time back in 2020 when we were really in the thick of things with COVID-19 and nobody really knew what the heck was going on and the impact that it would have on the business world. But back in April 2020, robotics companies raised about $600 million. So last month's $4.8 billion represents about a 700%+ increase in robotics investments year over year. Again, clearly coming out of COVID for the most part, right? Has it accelerated adoption of robotics? Has it increased the awareness of the benefits of automation? We'll get into that in a little bit. But the bulk of the funding, Mike, no surprise, came from two categories of robotics technologies: warehouse robotic systems, in particular ASRS systems, and then autonomous vehicles, AutoStore. They're based in Norway. They're one of the leading developers of ASRS systems. They raised $2.8 billion from SoftBank. That was basically half of the bund's total funding. And the shocking part is that $2.8 billion gives SoftBank just a 40% ownership stake of, wow, of AutoStore. So it just really shows you the growth trajectory for that company and mm-hmm. that type of system. And then the other one, autonomous vehicles, really no surprise there. Companies working on autonomous vehicles or enabling technologies for autonomous vehicles raised about $838 million. Cruise, I think they've raised around $7 billion to date since they were founded. They raised another $750 million, adding Walmart to its already impressive list of investors. They're doing some trials for last mile delivery type efforts down in the Houston area. But again, check it out on the robotreport.com. The more interesting ones, Lyft sold its autonomous vehicle division to Toyota for $500 million. So Lyft and Uber, two of the ride sharing giants in the world, are now both out of the autonomous vehicle game, having sold their divisions. The SPAC craze, Mike, which we're still trying to wrap our heads around, that continued. Vicarious entered a SPAC in the surgical robotics market. And then just yesterday, actually, Plus, autonomous trucking company, did the same thing, announcing that they're also going at the SPAC. So, I mean, what sticks out to you in these numbers?
Well, you know, I want to give a shout out to my longtime friends at Precise Automation, who announced last week that that company was acquired by Brooks Automation for a cool $70 million. You know, and that's a team that has been steadily progressing with collaborative robotics in the lab automation space for the last 20 years. They were one of the first companies with a collaborative robot in that market. And, you know, I think this investment or acquisition gives them what they need to finally expand their channel and their market reach. So that team's been working hard for a long time.
So how well do you know Brian? I don't know Brian that well, but I think this is at least the second company he's sold in the space, isn't it? Do you know that?
So Brian was CEO of Adept Technology when I was there in the early days. So that's how I know Brian and Bruce and several of the sales folks for that company. So that was really their next big gig after they left Adept, was to go create Precise.
Very cool. Yeah, I meant to ask you, and because we haven't done this in a little while, but didn't you go visit a farm or something recently? A winery, right? To check out the launch of, is it your favorite systems there, these autonomous tractors? How was that?
That's true. I had the chance late last month to head down to the Bay Area, and there was certainly some wine tasting involved. It was Advente Winery.
I thought I did see a lot of typos in that story. I thought that maybe that explains it.
Right. So it was a chance to go see this new Monarch autonomous tractor, which basically they handed over the keys of the first production unit to the team at Advente Winery in Livermore. And, I've followed their announcement way back last fall. And I got one of the few industry press folks invited to the launch. So yeah, it was fun to go see the tractor, sit in it, experience the autonomy. I miss all these trade shows and expo halls like everyone else. Chance to just meet and greet, and it felt like really first step of opening up again. A chance to get out and see live robotic something firsthand.
Anything, right?
Exactly.
Live robotic anything at this point. No, I went and visited, Waypoint Robotics up in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe a month or so ago when they were getting ready to announce their mobile manipulator, which we wrote about on the Robot Report and mobilerobotguide.com. Got a chance to get a sneak peek at that system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I hemmed and hawed about it for a little while. They were trying to get me out there even earlier, and I just kept putting it back, and everything was fine. I was there for a few hours. You know, we were indoors in their great facility, which is a large facility. They have all the filtration systems that you would want. Everyone was masked up. It was super safe, but it was my first time visiting a robotics company more than a year. Right. So it was kind of weird, right? If I'm being honest, it was kind of weird, you know? I don't know if I was kind of torn on how I felt after I left. I was like, I don't know if that was a great idea to be there. But you know, obviously everything was fine, but you know, I can't wait, man. I had a call this morning with our good friends at Mass Robotics. Mm-hmm. You know, they're trying to get me to come down there. They have a whole slew of new startups that have joined their facility. They're basically maxed out of space. And it finally seems like we've turned that corner. You're in California. I'm near the Boston area. Both of our respective areas are doing super well when it comes to mm-hmm. COVID numbers, right? What I don't know if I don't want to put you on the spot. Like, what are you guys at? You guys are way down now, right? Numbers wise.
I don't know the exact numbers, but you know, percentage wise, we're clearly moving in the right direction. And I think that's what's important, is that we get the opportunity to get some things back to normal and manage it.
Yeah, Massachusetts, I think is as of yesterday, was one of three states in the country to have 70%+ of the population receive at least one vaccine. That's the population that's eligible for the vaccine. Mm-hmm. I think Vermont and Hawaii are the other ones. So, I mean, you mentioned live events. I think live events will probably come back in some capacity this fall. I don't think they'll be, return to normal this fall. But yeah, I can't wait, man. You know, I never thought I would miss it, but certainly do miss it. But until then, Mike, let's get into our first story this week, an interview with A3 President Jeff Bernstein. We had the chance to interview Jeff last week as A3 released its Q1 numbers for the year. For North America, we should make sure we clarify that. But robot orders really surged in the quarter, especially in non-automotive applications. So we had Jeff on to sort of break down the numbers. Did COVID accelerate adoption? Is awareness about the benefits of automation really the credit for the increase? Is it a combination of things? Let's find out what Jeff had to say. Here's our conversation with Jeff Bernstein, A3 president. All right, Mike, this week, A3 released its numbers regarding robotic shipments across North America. Always a great read and some great statistics. Joining us now to analyze these numbers, the great Jeff Bernstein, president of the new and renewed Association for Advancing Automation, or A3. Jeff, thanks for coming back onto the podcast, sir. Hope all is well. But before we get to the numbers, Jeff, it is May the 4th. So May the 4th be with you. I got to ask, are you a Star Wars guy?
I'm not, but thanks for, for the greeting.
I'm not either. So don't worry about that.
Well, Jeff, you got to at least be a fan of the NASA Mars Perseverance mission and all the great things and robot related news that's coming out of JPL in the last three.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we're so excited about that. We're having Adam Stelzner from NASA come and speak about the recent Mars rover landing. So that'll be at the A3 Business Forum at the end of January next year.
Wow. Yeah, it's been fascinating to track and the helicopters moving on to a new phase and an aerial scouting mission. So will be fun to see how that performs. But Jeff, let's get to the numbers. So according to A3, the number of robots ordered by North American companies in the first quarter of 2021 increased about 20% compared to the first quarter of 2020. Order revenue also up 9%. To 466 million shipment on the shipment sides, units shipped grew 26%, while revenue increased nearly 9% to $451 million. So those numbers seem very, very positive. Just were you expecting this? So not that we're out of the pandemic, but I think people sort of understand how we've been in it for, 14, 15 months now. Was this, these numbers sort of what you expected before you analyzed everything?
Well, I guess I wasn't surprised that it was up. You know, we're more focused on the order numbers and the shipment numbers because those are more forward-looking. If you look at the fourth quarter of last year, it was, I think, the second best quarter we've ever had. So that was a strong indicator that we were really coming out of the worst of the pandemic. And now when you look at the first quarter of 2021, it's the second best first quarter we've ever had and one of the very best quarters of all time. So things are definitely trending up and we're very encouraged by where we're headed.
So Jeff, what are, looking back through the data then, what are your takeaways from this summary beyond just that everything's up? Can you read between some of the lines on some of the other application specific or industry specific numbers about what's going on in robotics?
Yeah. I mean, if you'll recall, last year was the first time we ever saw the non-automotive segment of the market be larger than the automotive sector. And we were very excited about that. Well, these trends in terms of the growth of non-automotive applications are continuing. And while they weren't larger this time, they were close to the automotive numbers and they're growing faster. The non-automotive segment grew in the first quarter 28% year on year, I believe. And the automotive plus automotive component sector up 12%. Which industries in the non-automotive sector were showing the fastest growth? Well, things like metals and life sciences and pharmaceutical and biomedical and food and consumer goods. So this is all a positive indicator for the expansion of robot adoption in a much wider range of industries than we've ever seen.
And I think your point about the life sciences industry would certainly fit that, you know, we're in the midst of a lot of automation and COVID testing laboratories around the world doing that, and especially here in North America, and maybe vaccine production. Do you think that's going to continue going forward? What are folks telling you about, you know, the, looking forward? You talk about looking forward for the over the next year. Certainly, we none of us believe we're out of this yet. So do you think it's going to be an industry, life sciences, that's going to be good investment? We also saw, you know, the acquisition this last week of Precise Automation, right? So there's some consolidation going on there as well. What else do you see going on in that market segment?
Well, we've always thought that was a promising space. You know, will it continue at this rate? Boy, I don't know. But I think long-term, it's a promising space. There's lots of application areas. So, you know, drug discovery is very important regardless of COVID. Pharmaceutical labeling, printing, packaging, all those things are important. Applications in biomedical, medical device. I think that's a promising area.
So obviously, I think COVID, I'm sure you would agree, Jeff, COVID has had something to do with the growth of these non-automotive applications or industries. How much would you credit to COVID, and what are the sort of aspects or you think leading to this growth in the non-automotive sectors?
Well, Steve, you know, I don't credit anything to COVID. COVID's been terrible.
Sure.
When you talk about, though, is COVID responsible for the growth of these sectors? I'll say no. I'll say that these things would have happened anyway, but COVID accelerated these trends. Mm-hmm. And I think we see it in this space. We see it in warehousing and logistics. There were a lot of people looking at automating. COVID forced their hand. You needed robots to create social distancing. You needed robots to do some disinfecting. You couldn't keep the factories up and running because you couldn't bring people in. You had to rely on the automation. And the automation came through with flying colors. So I think that's really what happened during COVID. It proved that automation plays a very important role in every industry, and I think that's going to continue onward.
What about collaborative robotics, Jeff? You mentioned, you know, second best first quarter ever. It reminds me of Teradyne recently announced its Q1 earnings for its industrial automation group. Two of the four industrial automation companies that it owns had tremendous first quarters. especially Universal Robots. They earned $66 million in Q1 revenue, up 32% year over year, 15% over Q1 2019. Teradyne said that this was a record for what it called a typically soft first quarter of the year. So certainly a great start for UR in the first quarter. Their sales dipped 12% last year overall, again, due primarily to the pandemic. But what are you seeing in terms of collaborative robotics companies and their trajectories going forward?
Well, I mean, everybody's getting involved in collaborative robots. So obviously the robot manufacturers see it as a big growth opportunity, which certainly borne out by these numbers that you just cited. I think part of it was certainly COVID driving the need to create social distancing, but also companies, again, small and medium-sized companies looking at automation, thinking that in many cases, a collaborative robot can be a solution, easier to use, maybe less costly, maybe require less internal resources. Now, that's not true for every application, of course, but certainly I think that's a gateway robot for a lot of companies getting started. So yeah, I think that's a long way to go in that space as well.
So Jeff, looking then beyond some, maybe the hard pieces of automation, when we talk about the arms and the mobile robots, you know, what other enabling technologies that are supporting the growth of robotics in North America, whether that's motor components or sensors or other elements, are also worth watching going forward, and that you're seeing some industry trends around?
Yeah, well, we certainly are seeing a lot of advances in vision, you know, 3D vision, 4D vision, lots of advances there. Artificial intelligence is applied to robotics, is applied to vision. Advances in gripping, which are certainly important when you look at picking pieces and warehouses and distribution centers. So I think those are key enabling technologies. We're happy that most of the, those types of developments are covered by our Association for Advancing Automation. We have segments for each of those technologies. So we're very encouraged by how these technologies fit together in a solution for companies. And that's why we rebranded as one association that companies can join instead of having to join several.
So let me ask you a question, Jeff. It's near and dear to my heart. Coming from the mobile robot side, you released a new mobile robot standard late last fall. And we, for example, just this week, Fetch was one of the first companies to announce that they've now compliant with that standard. Again, like continuing your role of driving this industry forward, you know, talk to us a little bit about what you think the mobile robot standard is going to bring for the mobile robot industry going forward. And again, the RIA/A3's role in developing standards going forward.
It's a critical role, and the standard is designed to make the workplace safer. Yep. So you have all these autonomous mobile robots running around, and that's going to increase. Safety is a top priority. This was part one. There'll be more parts to this, especially when you think about putting industrial robot arms on top of mobile platforms. So that's one whole segment of safety. And then you have this interoperability issue that we're working on in conjunction with other organizations that needs some standardization. You know, we're hearing that from user companies. I've got brand A and brand B. They don't talk to each other. That's not safe. So we're going to continue to play a major role in that area.
That's the big one, right? Interoperability for me. What are you hearing from the manufacturers of these autonomous mobile robots and other systems? I would assume they got to be pretty open to wanting their systems to talk with other systems from potential competitors or other companies. You know, that ability to communicate with other types of systems is certainly attractive to the end user customer. So what's the feedback? What's the mentality of some of these manufacturers that you're working with? They must be pretty on board with this.
Many of them are.
Oh, some of them aren't, though, is what I hear in that answer.
I can't address that, frankly, because Carol Franklin, who's our director of standards development,
yep,
she works on that, and she'd be the best person to ask. you know, I think that the customers want that. That's clear. Generally, you can say that the robot suppliers do what the customers want. So ultimately, we'll have interoperability solutions.
Sure. One thing I wanted to ask you, Jeff, you know, you often talk about robots and jobs, the benefits automation can bring to a variety of different sectors. You know, we're starting to see more public facing robots, you know, robots getting out of the labs, not just working in warehouses and manufacturing types of settings. One of these trials recently did not go so well in New York City. I'm not sure if you heard about this. The New York Police Department was trialing the Spot quadruped robot from Boston Dynamics, one of my favorite robots out there. And I'll say it this way. I think they kind of caved to the pressure from the public, and there were some politicians that were calling for them to stop using the robot. As they said, quote, it depicted the militarization of the police. Now, I know there's a whole lot of stuff going on in the world now around, you know, police force and, you know, brutality and all that kind of stuff. But how do robotics companies get over this stigma or, you know, the fear that the general public seems to have when it comes to robotics? It just seems like it's an ongoing and maybe an increasingly difficult issue for them to overcome, especially as these systems continue to make their way out into the public.
It's a tough challenge. I mean, you've got privacy issues. You've got the image that you just described of maybe seeming a little militaristic or something. So this is not going to be an easy issue to get the public comfortable with robots that are moving around autonomously. It's hard enough to get the public comfortable with robots that are working in factories.
Yeah,
I mean, we've been facing that issue for a long time. So, you know,
Hollywood, we've made a lot of progress in that, right?
We've made a tremendous amount of progress. Yeah. Hollywood images of the Terminator, you know, that is what a lot of people think of when they think of robots. So when they see the type of robot you saw, maybe that's what they're associating it with. Now, fortunately, some of the progress we made was during the pandemic, where people began to see that, hey, wait a minute. Robots are creating masks and PPE, and robots are helping keep our factory up and running when it's not safe to bring people in, and robots are helping disinfect the spaces that we work in. I think that is beginning to change the way people think about robots, but we've got a long way to go on this issue.
One of the things that a lot of folks had said about this situation in New York, and again, I'm not looking for you to comment on the specific situation, but is that the New York Police Department went about introducing the robot in the wrong way. Now there's all sorts of rules. You know, the pricing of this robot was out there. I think they spent $94,000 on this test run with the robot, and anything that they purchase or implement that's under $100,000, they don't have to have like a public hearing about implementing a new tool or new technology if it's under $100,000. So they didn't, you know, go to the public, have a hearing, say, hey, what are your thoughts on this? Perhaps something like that would have helped. But do you think the general public, even, you know, we're so close to this, the three of us on this conversation, we understand, you know, the robots that are involved in the supply chain and the manufacturing efforts to get us our products here on a, you know, 1 or 2 day basis from Amazons and Walmarts of the worlds. Do you think the general public is aware of that? And right now, even pre-COVID, the role that robotics played in manufacturing and delivering, you know, everyday items to them, and just building that awareness, would that have had any impact on changing sort of the outlook of what happened in New York?
I doubt it. I doubt that the general public has a complete awareness of what tools are used in factories to, you know, get their products delivered on time. I doubt it would have had any impact on what happened in New York. You know, the industrial robot and mobile robots that are used in warehouses, I think is a different category for the general public to something that they might see walking around a city. So it's tough. You know, I think that we saw in military applications, there's a lot of concern about military robots. Now, when you say that, hey, in the military so far, robots have been used primarily to find unexploded bombs and saving soldiers from stepping on those. People can kind of understand that, but they also can get the vision of, well, what's the next step? You're going to put a gun in the robot's hand and let the robot make the decision? That's kind of scary.
Yeah, I agree. And I think certainly with the climate of everything that's gone on, you know, maybe the police department did make a mistake, right? Not sort of slowly introducing it.
Could be. Yeah.
So Jeff, just maybe one last question here. What are you going to be looking forward, maybe next quarter, as we move forward into the year, be a little further deeper into the recovery and the reopening of the economy? You think these trends that we're seeing here in the first quarter are going to continue? What are your signals?
We don't make projections. Certainly think the second quarter should be good, but you know, who knows going after the look, I've been in this thing 40 years. It's very cyclical. Particularly when the automotive industry was driving everything. There's something for you. 70% of the robots were going into the automotive related sector. So it was extremely cyclical. Now we're starting to, you know, see that the non-automotive is helping buoy the overall segment. So I certainly expect there will be ups and downs, but I also believe we're in the early innings of automating. I think there's so many companies left to automate, many of whom have not even invested in one robot. So long way to go. Future looks bright. I think that 2021 should be a good year, and the future will be stronger. Will there be downturns? Of course.
You mentioned, Jeff, the A3 Business Forum, always a great event. Just curious as to your thoughts, you know, your plans, A3's plans, and I know it's ever changing, it could change going forward, but, you know, all of us on the call here are involved in live events. What are you guys thinking about live events for the rest of the year, even early 2022?
I expect we will have live events this year. Definitely we'll have the A3 Business Forum at the end of January. And we certainly will have Automate 2022, June 6 to 9 in Detroit next year. But yeah, I expect we will be back to live events this year.
Oh, hey, that's great to hear. Great to hear.
That's great to hear.
Well, hey, Jeff Bernstein, president of A3, the Association for Advancing Automation. Always great to talk to you, get your insights, pick your brain. And best of luck with everything that you guys do, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff.
Take care.
On to our next feature here, Mike. We recently sat down with Wibotics CEO and co-founder Ben Waters, and also their VP of Business Development, Matt Carlson. Of course, they're working on wireless charging for mobile robots, drones. Their system is also going to space in the near future. I know these guys quite well. What were your takeaways from our discussion with Ben and Matt from Wibotic?
Well, Steve, I've been watching Wibotic grow since they presented at a startup challenge several years ago. You know, and the idea of wirelessly charging batteries on board a mobile robot, you know, brings with it so many opportunities to improve the efficiency of AMR workflow, as well as integrate a heterogeneous fleet of AMRs on your manufacturing floor, your warehouse floor. So I think the great news for Wibotic is that, they just received CE approval to sell in Europe. That's a huge milestone for them. So opens up, the European continent. And I think they're getting ready to move forward with worldwide expansion. So kudos to them for that. And let's not forget that Wibotic also has a NASA contract now to build a wireless charging function into a future autonomous moon rover heading back out to space. So, these guys seem to be doing a lot of things right. And so let's listen to that interview now with Matt and Ben. So, Ben, why don't you start by explaining to the audience, what wireless charging is and briefly how it works.
Yes. So wireless charging is a topic that many folks are familiar with through cell phones, and wireless charging, as a concept, allows you to place your device onto a pad or a surface that can charge your phone without having to plug it in. And what makes our product unique is that we are focused primarily on the autonomous industry, mobile robots, aerial drones, automated industrial equipment, and so forth. And our products work similar to a cell phone wireless charging system with a couple of differences. The first being we operate at a much higher power level. We operate, in the hundreds of watts range, which is needed to charge a larger battery on board a robot in a reasonable amount of time. And our system enables a bit of flexibility. If you're familiar with the cell phone charging systems, you really do have to have the phone in contact with or sitting on top of the charging pad.
Mm-hmm.
For mobile robots and aerial drones, if this requirement were to exist, docking would be quite challenging. If you had to hit, millimeters of precision and contact, it kind of, deprecates the advantages in some cases of wireless charging. Because those robots, need a little bit of tolerance in their docking from one docking attempt to another. So the Wibotic system offers, tens of centimeters of flexibility, and anywhere within that zone, even if the antennas are misaligned, we can autonomously charge with full power and full efficiency. So Wibotic operates, in a near field wireless charging system. We are not beaming energy like some far field wireless power technologies have demonstrated in recent years. We're using electromagnetic fields to transfer power from one antenna to another with very high efficiency and very much optimized and thought through for all of the complicated edge cases that come along with an autonomous machine without a human in the loop to provide the intuition to know that the device is charging by seeing the icon on your phone light up. The robot needs a lot of information to make sure that it's going to get in the right position. It's going to be safe. You can begin charging and it's going to be optimized for the particular battery in that device.
Interesting. So Ben, thanks for sharing, that intro to the solution. And can you describe, are your systems optimized for a certain class or size of battery capacity or voltage or wattage? You alluded to that briefly during your response.
Right. As we learned early on in the robotics industry, different robots have different batteries. Some use 12 volt lead acid batteries. Others use 24 or 48 volt lithium ion or lithium iron phosphate batteries. We knew from the start that we wanted to build a charging ecosystem that could accommodate that whole ecosystem. And so our products are programmable in terms of the batteries they can charge. The user can programmatically set the charging voltage, the chemistry. In some cases, the charging algorithm used is different between, for example, a lead acid battery and a lithium battery. And the charge rate, the current limit is also programmable. We have a couple of different onboard chargers in our suite of products. The smaller ones can charge to a maximum of 5 amps, and our largest ones can charge to a maximum of 30 amps. But what that enables is if you imagine a warehouse, for example, that's got high utilization during the day, but lower at night, you can set the system to charge very quickly during the day. You can set the system to charge slower at night, which gives you a nice balance of making sure that you're also optimizing the longevity of the battery. Nobody wants to have to be going in and replacing batteries every 6 months because you've only charged them quickly. And as we all know, that can lead to shorter battery lifetimes. So we've implemented our system in this way. And beyond the hardware, there's a lot we've done on the software side, on the API side, to make it very easy to adapt these settings to different applications.
So Matt, I want to bring you in here. We obviously just talked about warehousing and AMRs and drones. Are one of those applications emerging as being more viable right now? Obviously, battery power is enormously important to scaling all of those applications. But what are you guys seeing as far as applications for wireless charging? Which ones are emerging right now?
Yeah, well, as Ben said, we focus really on anything that's autonomously driven. And for that reason, the mobile robotic space has been a little bit faster to mature for us. We're seeing, especially even with COVID, a real escalation in the deployment of now fleets of mobile robots. On the drone side, a little bit slower to mature for us, although it's still a very strong market. The challenge there is primarily regulatory. Beyond visual line of sight, flight is still not allowed universally. So the need for fully autonomous charging isn't quite there yet, but of course, everybody's moving in that direction. So we see huge growth in the drone space. But, you know, interestingly enough, we had an announcement on a NASA project that we're involved in last fall. So now we're looking at space robots. We've also done some underwater charging. So the need for wireless, I think, spans all of those industries. But to date, it's primarily been mobile robots.
Interesting. So can you, Ben, maybe you can take us a little bit deeper on the advantages of wireless charging over, you know, sort of the contact-based charging stations that most of the vendors are supplying with their systems, and why your solution is maybe more advantageous for the end user.
Definitely. Yeah. I would say the majority of companies who have been building robots for many years now started with contact-based charging stations. There have not historically been many companies providing, you know, off-the-shelf wireless charging systems suitable for these applications. And contact-based charging systems, of course, are subject to more mechanical wear and tear over time. You know, the robot's physically connecting to a contact in a contact-based system. And robots are large devices. They do not plug themselves in as gently as perhaps a person would plug something into a device. And so the contacts are susceptible to reaching their end of life in terms of how many times they've mated together, and you know, the plastic can break down or the contacts can break down or require cleaning. And as the robotics market matures, I think these types of problems need to be vetted out by the companies building and using these robots, because if they're not, it means that you're going to have a whole bunch of charging stations and a whole bunch of robots that are going to need to have things replaced on them much more frequently. And in some cases, you know, randomly, which I would say is the worst thing that can happen. If you've got a warehouse and all of a sudden something breaks when you're not expecting it to break, now you've got to stop things. You have downtime, which has substantial cost behind it. And these are big challenges. Wireless charging, you know, of course, doesn't require the physical contact. And so you don't have this, you know, factor of mechanical wear and tear over time. But one of the things that we've been exploring at Wibotic as well is the concept of opportunity charging. We've seen and studied this in many customer scenarios, that if you really optimize the logistics around charging, you can either have fewer robots required to do the same amount of work, which saves money upfront and saves money in terms of how many devices you need to support over time. And you can also increase productivity. You can have the robots not spending as much time charging and more time spent being used. What we mean by that is, you know, opportunity charging by definition, I think, is the idea of a robot does a task and then it's going to sit for a minute. It might not be doing tasks continuously for the full period of the day. So during those natural downtimes, if you can have the device charge, even if only for a few minutes, but more frequently, this, if done right, does not have any effect on degrading the battery life. In fact, in some cases, it's better if you always keep the battery, you know, in more of a middle ground in terms of its state of charge, rather than always draining it down and then always charging it all the way up as quickly as possible. So wireless, of course, is advantageous for that, because now you're having more charging cycles throughout the course of the day, and contacts would only wear down faster. So with respect to wireless charging and contact charging, we certainly see the advantage of wireless. We also work with many customers on contact-based systems because our onboard chargers can be used with a DC input with all the advantages of the APIs and the certifications that we've already achieved. So while we are primarily focused on the wireless charging space, we certainly understand that some applications have requirements that might be amenable to both types of charging, and our systems can support both.
Interesting. So Ben, are you seeing some of the early opportunities for your solution in helping customers who might have heterogeneous fleets of, for example, mobile robots? They might have mobile robots from multiple vendors on the floor, and being able to eliminate the proprietary contact charger with a single type of platform that wirelessly charges, you know, any of the vehicles that might happen to you know, be running.
Yeah, definitely. I think the word interoperability comes up more and more in discussions we have with customers and partners. And mm-hmm. interoperability, I think, in the robotics world means having different types of robots being able to operate with the same infrastructure. And that could be hardware infrastructure, that could be software infrastructure, you know, et cetera. So when it comes to the charging infrastructure, we have many customers today that have this scenario. They've got different types of robots for different types of applications in the same facility. Might be floor cleaning for one application, might be material handling for another, all operating in the same space. Mm-hmm. And if each of those robots has to have a separate charging station, you know, I think it exponentially complicates things when things need to be serviced or maintained. You know,
they're going to need a bigger warehouse.
That's right. They're going to need a bigger warehouse. The system that we've architected, you know, you can have the same onboard charger across different robots, each which could be totally different shape and size. You could have a totally different battery. The battery charging settings are stored on our onboard charger, which integrates with the vehicle. And then any of those vehicles can go to the same charging station. We have a mechanism for which our system does, you know, a handshake to kind of confirm that it's a authenticated device. And there's an understanding between the charging station and the onboard charger about the battery settings, which are stored on the device itself. And then that same charger can charge those different types of batteries with whatever power setting and voltage setting that happens to be set. So we certainly have architected our system to be very amenable for interoperability. And I think that's going to continue to be a very important concept for many users of robots as things keep scaling up here.
Matt, I want to bring you back in here. As you mentioned, the project Vibotic is involved in with NASA in outer space. We absolutely love space robots here on the podcast. I think about half the episodes that we've done have involved some sort of space robotics discussion. So for people who may not be aware, and Ben, I have a follow-up for you after, but Matt, let's start here. Just for folks who may be unaware of that project, what is Vibotic doing when it comes to wireless charging systems for outer space and lunar robots?
Sure. So as a part of the of NASA's Artemis project to return humans to the moon, there's obviously a lot of equipment that will also be going to the moon, and autonomous robots doing various experimentation, you know, on all areas of the moon, both dark areas and light areas. So there's huge temperature fluctuations and other things that make it very difficult to deploy robots. We are a subcontractor to Astrobotic, which makes the Cube Rover. The Cube Rover is a small roving device that is not really large enough to have a massive solar array of its own in order to recharge its batteries. And of course, if it's operating in darkness, it would very quickly run out of battery charge and have no way to recharge. So we are providing a wireless charging system where, you know, base stations, for lack of a better term, with large solar arrays can charge up a bank of batteries, and then the Cube rovers can approach and recharge at any time and continue on with their experimentation. And that's a project that we just announced. Astrobotic announced their funding through NASA in the fall, and announced our partnership with them to do the charging piece.
So Ben, obviously Wibotics Solutions have been operating in a variety of commercial, industrial environments, even military environments. So they're used to operating in some dusty, dirty environments, but certainly not used to operating on the moon or anything even close to operating on the moon in outer space. What are some of the challenges you guys are facing in designing your system, or maybe transitioning your system to be able to operate in outer space?
Right. Yeah, I think, Steve, you said it well. You know, charging in different types of environments has been something that we've learned a lot about. Space is a different beast. And for space, you know, you cannot, for example, rely on fans to keep things cool because they don't transfer any air in a vacuum. You have radiation, which is, you know, pretty substantial on the moon in some cases, and using radiation hardened components, having firmware be able to, you know, detect and you know, protect itself in these types of events are big engineering challenges. But we're certainly excited about it because some of these things are things that we want to do with our standard commercial products anyways, building more reliability, building greater you know, support for wider operating temperature ranges, for example. You know, drones operating outdoors in the hot sun can be subjected to pretty high ambient temperatures, not quite as high as what the moon can experience, but certainly those are things that we're excited about working towards. And great to be partnered with Astrobotic, who has years and years and years of experience designing things for this. So we're excited to work towards taking our existing designs, making them space qualified in this tipping point project, and certainly for many other robots that are being developed for applications on the moon. We hope that this, in the same way that it's amenable to different robots in the commercial setting today, certainly hope that this can be a solution that will work for different types of battery powered systems in space down the road.
I could imagine. Yeah. I mean, based on your current drone capabilities, that, you know, the idea of wireless could even work for this, you know, the next generation of space helicopters to come back to a charging platform and, you know, reduce the onboard, you know, I mean, every gram counts on that in helicopter, right? So taking the solar panels off the helicopter and putting them on a base unit to recharge, it could be a viable future for that device.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think, you know, solar, of course, is the way in which most things in space have been charged or powered. Mm-hmm. One of the unique things about this tipping point work is NASA really wants to operate at night and survive the lunar night. Surviving the cold lunar night is one thing, but being able to operate at the lunar night, you know, requires other means for charging in addition to solar, because there's mm-hmm. no sun. And
it's
so
it's a long night.
And it's a long night, exactly. So yeah. So we're excited about enabling some of those types of missions, and certainly solar will be a part of the ecosystem, right? Solar will probably be the thing that charges up a big battery bank that provides power to the charging station. But you've got a lot more, you've got, you know, less weight restrictions, and, you know, you can do more things with batteries offboard the vehicle than you can onboard the vehicle. So, so we agree. We think that's going to be a new enabling thing for some of these vehicles to operate longer, you know, at times that they've not been able to operate to date. And we shall see.
All right. So I guess we'll all stop geeking out about space for a moment and come back to Earth, bring everybody back to Earth and talk a little bit more about maybe your short-term business now. Are you guys seeing more opportunities for retrofits? I mean, in terms of your current client base, retrofitting existing fleets or are new installations, new equipment? Are you establishing some partnerships with some new OEMs for your technology who are embedding? What can you tell our audience about where business is going for you for the immediate term?
Yeah, I can answer quickly and then I'll turn it over to Matt to chime in too. But Webotic, we've really worked with two types of customers. We work with the manufacturers of the robots and have a lot of partnerships with many of them to integrate our onboard charger into the vehicle and outfit the charging station either in a standalone format or into a customized industrial designed docking station. And then we also work with the end users. In some cases, the end users are using robots that they design in their own facilities. And in other cases, they're leveraging robots from the manufacturers, some of whom we work with and some of whom we might not. But you know, our product is amenable to being fully integrated and designed in or added as an aftermarket item onto the to the device and enabling autonomous charging in an interoperable fashion that way. Matt, you want to add anything about use cases and anything?
Yeah, I would just say that there's also a little bit of a hybrid there where we're working with some OEMs who are making retrofit kits for all of the robots that they already have fielded. And I don't want to steal their thunder and do a pre-announcement, but one of our partners, who's an OEM, will be announcing some kits that existing customers going back for several years will be able to buy and easily install and retrofit their robots with wireless charging going forward. So we, you know, as Ben said, we work with both of those types of customers. And I can't say that, you know, really one or the other is a bigger part of our business. It's really kind of a nice blend.
Yeah, we know the folks at Waypoint Robotics quite well, and I know you guys partnered with them on their end zone wireless charging system. So they have nothing but great things to say about you guys. So kudos on that partnership. I want to bring Ben or Matt, I guess we'll start with you on this one, Matt. The recent announcement about Webotic receiving CE mark approval, for two of its wireless charging systems seemingly open the door for you guys to do business in Europe. Can you tell us a little bit about, Matt, your plans to expand in Europe?
Yeah, we've had a number of customers who've been who've purchased our products in the past for, you know, evaluation use and demonstration use, but this really sort of opens up the door to larger deployments, fleet deployments in actual production environments. The regulatory environment in Europe is obviously quite stringent. We went through the process with the FCC here in the US as an initial step, just based on locality and a lot of our customers being in the US. But a lot of our demand and incoming inquiries these days are coming from European companies, both on the mobile robotic side and the drone side. So we wanted to follow up what we did with our FCC certifications with the CE process. And we learned a lot from the FCC process. And I would say the CE process went quite a bit faster, but it is a little different. And so, you know, we went through all of the proper testing and channels to make sure that we complied with all of the various regulations. And we're super excited to now have the CE mark and to be able to ship, you know, freely to any customer in the EU.
So just to follow up, if I can, so how are you building out the sales channel in Europe? Is it sort of the same breakdown, you know, not only looking for OEM machine builders, but also end user customers, same types of systems, AMRs, drones, you know, any sort of autonomous machine? What can you tell us?
Yeah, so historically we've had a direct sales model where we've handled, you know, the sale with either an end user or direct to an OEM partner. We are just beginning to entertain and expand with a channel model. So there are some very good integration partners, and particularly on the drone side of the business, some great distributor partners. And now that we have kits available that are, you know, relatively easy for end users to retrofit onto existing products, a channel model makes a lot more sense for us. So I would say we're at the very early stages of that, but that's definitely the direction we're going.
So look, we've talked about your hardware and electronics up to this point, but I think you guys also have some interesting software aspects to the solution that someone might not realize at first. So, you know, what can you tell us about Wibotic Commander? Can you describe the software architecture and maybe what functions you manage on board the vehicle with the onboard charging system so that our listeners maybe can better understand exactly the types of functions that you take over and manage on board the vehicle?
Yeah, definitely. In a nutshell, Wibotic Commander is a tool that is intended to tie into a company's fleet management ecosystem. And Wibotic Commander particularly handles fleet energy management. So if you are a warehouse or a robot manufacturer that's deploying one robot into 100 different sites or 100 robots into a single site, historically, there really has been very little or no insight into the charging stations themselves. The charging stations are typically analog power supplies that are not communicating any data about status or availability. You know, all that's kind of managed on the robot side. What we've done with Commander is added, you know, a digital element to both the charging station and the onboard charger. So, for example, what this enables is the robots always have an awareness of where the charging stations are, where they are relative to the charging stations, which charging station is available, which is in use. And as companies grow, we have a lot of analytics that we look at across Wibotic Commander systems and can help inform the companies on ways to further improve the uptime of the robots or relocate the charging stations in such a way that you have a more even power distribution. You know, you don't want to have scenarios where you'd have all of the robots need to go charge at once. The warehouse may not even have an energy budget for that. If you've got a thousand watt chargers, for example, you've added a megawatt to your energy load, and the warehouse is, you know, may not be able to handle that in some cases. So mm-hmm. Commander is a tool that really looks at the energy across autonomous fleets. And, you know, the evolution of Commander was we've always had an API that we include with the hardware. It allows for customers to interface with the robots. We have drivers that allow for that API to work nicely within ROS and allow for the robot to seamlessly communicate with the onboard charger. Similarly, we have an API for the transmitter to communicate to a network that can be accessed. And all that is still available, you know, at no cost with the hardware. Commander's an added element that, you know, really helps companies achieve better ROI on their utilization of the robots. And so Commander's a new tool that was developed really as customers, you know, asked for more features in the API and didn't necessarily have time to integrate all of it into a nice format themselves. And so we built it as a tool that would make that easy for folks to adopt and hopefully eliminate some of the bottlenecks around power and charging as they scale up the fleet.
So just to make sure I heard you correctly, then you've got the APIs for onboard that manage the actual battery charging cycle. And so an OEM machine builder doesn't have to build that into their onboard systems. And then on the terrestrial side of the charging, the actual stationary charging unit, there you've got APIs that can communicate with any supervisory systems, and that's a core part of your system. And then Commander is an add-on fleet management software that's an additional package. Did I get that right?
Exactly. Yep.
Great.
I want to bring up everybody's favorite topic is standards. I think I hear Mike falling asleep over there as I bring this up, but it's an important topic. And there was recently a standard released, Matt and Ben, about more about AMR safety. I have heard some talk about, you know, what's going on with charging standards. Have you guys heard anything about that? Are you fans of having some sort of standards around charging when it comes to autonomous mobile robots?
Yeah, certainly the various robot and AMR safety standards of the world already do talk quite a bit about charging stations and needing to ensure inherent safety measures around contacts or things like this, which are very challenging, right? It's very difficult to prove inherent safety around something that, you know, could be easily touched by somebody, you know, near the system, or risk of short circuit should there be water or dust buildup. You know, those are really challenging things and take a lot of time to do. Our approach has been, let's make sure that our systems are certified to those standards so that when the robot companies need to go through their own standardization and certification with their complete systems, they don't have to, you know, they can just check the box for the things related to the charging stations, right? So we've certainly focused our efforts around the safety requirements for those types of things. You know, the CE mark that we have now, you know, has an element of electronic and mechanical safety to it, which basically corresponds to many of the ISO standards that the robot safety standards reference. As you mentioned, Steve, you know, there are also growing standards around battery charging in general, charging efficiency. In some cases, it's at a state by state level on some of those things. And so Wibotic certainly is proactively taking steps to make sure that, you know, the products that we build can meet those requirements, again, with the goal being to make it easy for folks to scale up without unexpected bottlenecks. So yes to all of the above. You know, I think that the big challenges for us are that on the wireless charging front, not all countries have adopted a ubiquitous standard. So in some cases, the certification efforts we have to go through for the wireless charging piece are on a country by country basis. And of course that means, you know, more time and more cost to get through those things. We're also looking at, you know, the general electronic safety standards, which are a little bit more adopted worldwide, and therefore, you know, we can do them once and applies to many different geographies. And, you know, keeping an eye on the charging standards of the world. The other one that I think is really interesting is, you know, if you look at FAA for drone related applications there, I'd say at the early stages of thinking about for battery powered systems, how do we, you know, the FAA think about requirements for battery safety? You know, battery is going to change over time. So unlike filling your plane with gas, it's not just going to be the same thing all the time. You might have to have one thing as the batteries early on and another thing as the battery ages. And then what circuits and systems are required on board the vehicles to make sure that you're complying with those standards and testing to those standards. And none of that's been fully defined yet, but a lot of people are thinking about it, and we certainly are as well.
Matt, following on this similar conversation, what barriers do you think exist to the wider adoption of wireless charging for AMRs and drones and maybe even some other applications?
Yeah, you know, I think adoption is going to come naturally as people expand the size of their fleets. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things we've seen is just that there's been a natural progression as people have gone from a single pilot to maybe a small scale fleet to now going to larger and larger fleets. And the recognition that power management and management of the batteries is an important piece. It only increases as they go through that process. And they begin to realize that, you know, batteries are a major expense in the long run. And so what can they do to optimize the performance of batteries over time and also just get better reliability out of charging in general? And that's where I think people really start to consider some of these issues. They're starting to see, you know, a breakdown in the mechanical contacts. They're starting to see that, boy, I charge my battery at 100% rate and to the maximum voltage every time, because that's just the way this charger that came from the manufacturer works. But unfortunately, that limits me to, you know, maybe 400 charge cycles. Whereas if I could tweak things a little bit, I mean, I don't need to charge that fast, especially if I've got overnight to charge my battery. Why not slow the charge rate down and spend a little more time and get 800 charge cycles out of a battery, reduce my battery costs, and just have better overall performance? Mm. So I think, you know, that it's an experience thing. I think as fleets grow and costs to maintain those fleets grow, the benefits of wireless power begin to really show themselves. But to Ben's point earlier, even if wired is an option that works, our chargers have that intelligence built in and the APIs to be able to send those signals to them to say, you know, slow down the charging for this cycle or speed it up for this one, to truly optimize how power is being delivered. So that's something we built into the products from the very beginning.
And maybe we can wrap up with this one. I believe you guys were founded in what, 2015, sort of officially announced yourself back in 2017 after raising some funding. I remember Wybotic competed in our pitch fire startup competition at Robo Business 2017. I think you guys came in third, so I apologize about that. But, you know, we have a lot of robotic startups who we interact with who listen to this, and, you know, a lot of them, frankly, don't make it even this long, right? So you guys have been around for, you know, going on 6+ years now. Just from your perspective, what's the journey been like, and what do you think are the keys that have kept Wybotic going so successfully for the last 6 years?
Yeah, it's an important question, I think. And we are certainly grateful to be where we are. We raised the Series A in 2020 amidst the challenges of the pandemic and everything else. And I think, you know, for me personally, as a technical co-founder prior to this, I had only, this was my first full-time job. You know, I came out of grad school from the University of Washington and really had to rely heavily on smart folks around me, like Matt and like some of our advisors at Wybotic, to figure out what it means to fundraise and what it means to build a business and what it means to manage cash flow. We, and I think I speak for our whole team, investors included at Wybotic, really do believe in the robotics industry and have really tried to maintain a sense of focus and building reliability into our products for those industries. It's a simple concept. It's simple conceptually, but it's so challenging in the day-to-day of a startup to maintain a sense of focus, because you have so many opportunities and ideas that come up on customer calls that could, you know, pull you a little bit into a different direction. And how you choose to go about those things, I think, really impacts, you know, not only the company direction, but, you know, culture and team and everything else. And so, you know, for me, the things that we've really tried to do at Wybotic are, number one, maintain a sense of focus, you know what we need to go do and where we need to be in a year and 5 years, and work to make that happen. Second, I think on the cash flow side, being in a market that is still emerging, you know, we've had to be very aware of our cash and, you know, the fact that sales cycles in this whole industry, not just for Wybotic, I think for the robotic companies as well, are long, and it takes a while to go from prototype to production. And we kind of need to balance making sure we're far enough ahead where we have products that are reliable and ready to go, but not so far ahead that we've, you know, exhausted all our resources and aren't going to survive long enough for the industry to keep growing, right? So, you know, I think for me personally, it's really come down to maintaining that sense of focus, you know, having kind of a self-reflection process integrated into your company strategy, just, you know, really being open and honest with, you know, where's the market? What do we really need to do now versus, you know, what can we wait to do later? And just not losing sight of that, I think, is so important for any business. It's been critical to our success. And we certainly still have a long way to go, but we've got a strong core team, and we have really benefited from patient and great partners and customers to help us work through things with our product as we continue to mature it. And hopefully we've helped them, you know, not have to worry so much about power and charging.
Well, Ben and Matt, thanks for joining us on the show this week. And for our listeners, if you want to learn more about Wibotic, you can find them on the web at wibotic.com. And gentlemen, look, it's been a fascinating conversation. I think we could have talked about space robotics for another hour. We'll have to save that for a future conversation. But until then, hey, we congratulate you on the achievement of the CE mark, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate you taking the time to chat with us, and look forward to doing it again soon.
Thanks again to those guys. Also, some great advice, Mike, for the robotics startups who are listening to the program. But that's about going to do it for us, folks, for episode 42 of the Robot Report podcast. Thanks again to Jeff Bernstein, Ben Waters, and Matt Carlson for joining the program today. New episodes of the Robot Report podcast drop each week. We're on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcast. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. Don't forget, folks, to check out our Robo Business Direct series, which continues May 20th. We'll examine construction robotics, the critical needs and functional gaps in a $10 trillion market. That's trillion with a T. Attendees will hear from three innovators in the construction robotics market, while they also learn about the ways that automation is changing the industry. Again, all kicks off at 2 p.m. Eastern on May 20th. To register and check out the full schedule, please visit robobusinessdirect.com. And on behalf of Mike Oitzman and the entire Robot Report crew, I'm Steve Crow. Take care, everyone. We'll talk to you again next week.